Good afternoon. Hi, everyone. My name is Amin Kalbian, and I'm the chair of the religion department here at FSU, and I want to welcome all of you here this afternoon to and look forward to hearing this fascinating lecture by Dr. Scharf. I wanted just to let you know, in case you didn't, that this year is the 50th anniversary of the Department of Religion here at FSU, and so this lecture, which is an annual lecture, is part of a year-long series that we're having of lectures that address various issues that are important to religious studies and to the various areas in our department. I left some copies of our newsletter in the back that lists some of these lectures, and I urge you also to check our website regularly for updates about these various lectures. So I want to introduce Dr. Yu to introduce our speaker. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming out. My name is Jimmy Yu. I'm responsible for teaching Chinese Buddhist Studies here at the Department of Religion. It's my honor and pleasure to introduce the speaker of this afternoon, Dr. Robert Scharf. He is the H.D. Chen Distinguished Professor of Buddhist Studies at UC Berkeley, the Department of East Asian Languages and Culture, and the director of the Center of Buddhist Studies there. He has also taught at the University of Michigan for many years, from 1995 to 2003. I met him when he was there, in the late 90s. And before that, at McMaster from 1989 to 95. Afterwards, he went on to Berkeley, and I would like to see it as him single-handedly rebuilt the Buddhist Studies program there, which had been defunct for many years. It used to be a very strong presence of Buddhist Studies at UC Berkeley. So after he went there and restarted the program. For the past 30 years, Dr. Scharf has been at the forefront, the cutting edge of Chinese Buddhist Studies, shaping the field and pushing its boundaries through interdisciplinary ways. He's the author of Coming to Terms with Chinese Buddhism, co-author of Living Images, Japanese Buddhist Icon in Context, and about 30 influential articles, many of which can be found in publications beyond Buddhist Studies. For example, he has an article in Critical Terms for Religious Studies, edited by Mark Taylor, or Religious Experience, a Reader, Critical Categories in Study Religion, edited by Craig Martin and Russell McCutcheon, name many of you know. In nearly every aspect of Chinese Buddhist studies, in general, whether one's interested in Buddhist doctrine, material culture, syncretism, ritual, Buddhism and politics, Buddhist experience, he's got an article on that topic. For example, in recent years, we're witnessing the rise of this new modern mindfulness movement by proponents in both neuroscience and teachers in the Vipassana tradition. Dr. Scharf is one of the first Buddhist scholars who critique this kind of decontextualized, ahistorical claim of meditation as therapeutic by these proponents. And tonight, Dr. Scharf will venture into a related topic to critique the phenomena of Buddhist reform, both past and present. His topic is taking critical Buddhism seriously. Please join me to welcome Dr. Robert Scharf.
So thanks very much to Jimmy Yu for inviting me here and for hosting me, and Brian Cuevas, who's also been a very nice host. And it's been it's very much a pleasure being involved in this, especially because the department is celebrating its 50th year, and I'm getting to learn more about your program and the university. It's been a real pleasure to be here. So in the 730s, a charismatic Buddhist meditation master, whose name is Shen Hui, gave a series of public lectures in the Tang Dynasty capital of China. The lectures were attended by a host of monastics and laypersons, including senior Chan teachers. Chan, by the way, is the Chinese term for Zen. So I think I'll just substitute Zen for today, but know that I'm talking about the Chinese version of that. So including senior Zen teachers and prominent government officials. In his lectures, Shen Hui boldly attacked the most illustrious meditation masters of the time. He vilified them for lying about their credentials, for their lack of spiritual insight, and for their misguided approach to practice. He was impassioned and uncompromising. At the beginning of one of these lectures, in his initial intense exchange with his opponent, he became so frustrated and indignant and angry that he just refused to speak anymore. And things got going again only after some senior meditation teachers in the audience started shouting for him to get a hold of himself and sit down and give his lecture. So Shen Hui promoted his understanding of the Buddha's teachings, the Dharma, under the banner of the Southern School. It's the Southern Zen School, which he claimed originated with the historical Buddha and was passed down through the generations until it was bestowed upon Huineng, who was his own teacher. According to the tradition, and this is a tradition that we now know Shen Hui was largely responsible for creating, Huineng was an illiterate youth from the provinces who, through his innate spiritual gifts, came to occupy the exalted position as the sixth patriarch of Chan. And this was before he even ordained as a monk. That's according to the mythology. So Shen Hui's name and role in this myth-making were largely forgotten in later East Asian history, but his efforts were not in vain. The later Chan, Zen, and the Song tradition of Korea all claimed to be heirs of Huineng and this Southern school. We know about Shen Hui today because of manuscripts that were found at Dunhuang at the beginning of the 20th century. Now, some 12 centuries later, in the mid-1980s, two Japanese scholars, Matsumoto Shiro and Hakamaya Noriaki, who were both Buddhist scholars teaching at the Soto Zen-affiliated university, Komazawa University in Tokyo, they stirred controversy by attacking the Japanese Buddhist tradition in general and their own Soto Zen establishment in particular for being non-Buddhist or un-Buddhist. And the focus of their criticism was the doctrine of original enlightenment, or Hongaku, which they believed diverged fundamentally from the Buddha's original teaching of conditioned co-arising. And they called for a return to authentic Buddhism, which they called critical Buddhism. Now, scholars in both Asia and the West tend to view both of these reform movements with considerable skepticism. Shen Hui has been painted as an unscrupulous opportunist whose evangelical talents were matched only by his unbridled ambition. And Matsumoto and Hakamaya don't get off much easier. They're accused of placing their normative sectarian agendas ahead of scholarly rigor and objectivity. And in both cases, the specific criticisms of these would-be reformers are accorded little attention or respect. Their doctrinal positions are dismissed as historically naive and philosophically shallow. Their rhetoric is castigated as hyperbolic, and their motivations are considered dubious. So I'm going to suggest today that these folks have been given short shrift. There are intriguing areas of overlap between their critiques. In other words, the 8th century critique of Shen Hui and the 20th century critique of the Japanese scholars. And the issues they raise are germane not only to our appreciation of Buddhist intellectual history, but also to our analysis of Buddhist modernism and the Buddhist-inspired meditation practices that have become so popular today. So let me begin with the critical Buddhists. Matsumoto and Hakamaya are not lightweights. The former is an accomplished scholar of Madhyamika, it's a particular school of Buddhist philosophical thought, and the latter is a specialist in Yogacara, another tradition, and their critiques draw heavily on their knowledge of Indian Buddhist doctrinal and scholastic history. Specifically, their notion of what it means to be critical and their emphasis on causality draw from two major streams in classical Buddhist thought. The first is Abhidharma, in which freedom is achieved via the systematic investigation of the underlying cognitive machinery that generates the illusion of a stable and enduring objective world. The second is early Madhyamaka, in which one overcomes attachment through a rigorous logical analysis that reveals the phenomenal world to be a discursive construct. Everything we know about the world, according to the Madhyamikans, and indeed everything that can be known about the world, is concept dependent and therefore relative. According to some Madhyamikas, the only thing that can be known for certain is that nothing can be known for certain. Or in Buddhist parlance, absolute truth is the truth that all truth is conventional, or not absolute. So the force of both Abhidharma and Madhyamika analysis is deconstructive insofar as both traditions employ critical analysis to undermine the seeming integrity of the world that's presented to our senses. And the critical Buddhists are very quick to draw analogies with Descartes. So the illusion that holds the greatest sway over us, the one most responsible for our grasping and suffering, is that of an enduring self, or an agent, or a me, that stands at the center of this flow of phenomena. The deconstructionist strand in Buddhism holds that there is ultimately no permanent self, or subject, or ground of being, but only a causally conditioned flux. So that's one strand. But there's another strand in Buddhist thought, and this is the one that is targeted by Matsumoto and Hakamaya. And it shows up in Buddhism under a variety of rubrics. The terms are Tathagatagarbha, which means something like the matrix or the womb of Buddhahood, Dharmadhatu, or the realm of the absolute, Buddha nature, original enlightenment, and so on. And according to this strand, there is a pre-existing or perduring something that lies behind, or is intrinsic to, or is the source of, or is immanent within all phenomena. And the nature of this spatially and temporally unbounded something is the subject of exegesis and debate. But the advocates of these doctrines all insist that without such a pre-existing ground, Buddhahood would be impossible. You just couldn't. It's got to be there. And furthermore, that their positions are fully compatible with the more deconstructive Abhidharma and Madhyamika teachings. Be that as it may, many modern scholars, including Matsumoto and Hakamaya, find the compatibility arguments unconvincing, since the idea of an unchanging, innate, and immanent essence or ground that underwrites enlightenment seems irreconcilable with the denial that there's anything unchanging, innate, or immanent. So according to the critical Buddhists, this Buddha nature tradition is an accretion from Brahmanic or Hindu or non-Buddhist culture that diverges from Orthodox Buddhist teachings. And more to the point, they find this Buddha nature teaching, or the Tathagatagarbha teachings, intellectually and ethically toxic. And they lament that it was this corrupted form of Buddhism that came to prevail in East Asia, squeezing out the more critical and authentic alternatives. Now, Matsumoto and Hakamaya are particularly concerned with the ethical ramifications of Buddha nature thought. In their view, the doctrine of universal Buddha nature holds that the phenomenal world is inherently pure or perfect just as it is. Social justice doesn't exist, or social injustice doesn't exist in the world per se, but rather in our deluded perception of the world. Buddha nature thought therefore undermines the moral imperative to stand against social inequity and political repression. As historical evidence for the pernicious ethical effects of monism, they cite Brahmanism and Hinduism, whose monistic teachings countenance the caste system. But this is their claim. So Matsumoto and Hakamaya's understanding of the relationship between metaphysics, on the one hand, and social ethics, on the other, is one of the more controversial aspects of their project, to put it simply, and I'm not going to explore it and much less defend it here. Suffice it to say that in their minds, whereas the doctrine of inherent Buddha nature leads to ethical, social, and political passivism, critical Buddhism, their kind of Buddhism, entails social critique and political engagement. And something I'm not going to pursue here, but what is interesting about their critique is it's really driven by this kind of social justice agenda. Now, Matsumoto and Hakamaya coined the term Datu Vada. I'm going to use that a lot, Datu Vada, or it translates as maybe element theory or locus theory, for this strand, this Tathagatagarbha Buddha nature original awakening strand that they find so objectionable. Hakamaya also uses the term topical Buddhism because it presupposes a topos or a place for the same thing. Now, by element or locus or topos, they mean a singular abiding ground or metaphysical substrate. And they see little difference between Buddhist Datuvada and the monistic Atmavada teachings found in the Upanishads. And that's this notion that there is a true self, an Atman, kind of soul, that is none other than the eternal Brahman or Godhead in each and every one of us. So normative Buddhist texts may denigrate Atmavada as heterodox, but Matsumoto and Hakamaya say that this Buddha nature stuff, it's basically Atmavada in all but name. Now, like many Western scholars, I have little interest in determining what is authentic or orthodox Buddhism. I side with scholars like Ruig, who believe that both the deconstructive and monistic strands coexisted within Buddhism, often in dynamic and productive tension from very early on. The critical Buddhists versus the Datuvada opposition is structurally analogous to a number of other important moieties that have sustained Buddhist philosophical discourse through the century, such as Vipassana versus Shamatha, this is or insight versus concentration, Samvritti Satya versus Paramartha Satya, which is conventional truth versus absolute truth, Anumana versus Pratyaksha, or inference versus perception, sudden versus gradual, and for the Buddhologists here, Prasangika versus Vatantrika, and Rangtong versus Shentong, and so on. Indeed, such dialectical oppositions are unavoidable. You simply can't make sense of what it means to be relative or conventional without some notion of an ultimate or an absolute. So we shouldn't be surprised that Shen Hui and the critical Buddhists turn out to be wrestling with the same complex issues. My point of departure today is the observation that dialectical thinking, which has been part and parcel of Buddhist thought from its origins, has been all but abandoned in the forms of Buddhism that are popular of late. Buddhist modernists have disowned the more critical and dialectical voices within the tradition and thrown in their lot with Datuvada. And it is for this reason that I think the concerns and critiques of people like Shen Hui and Matsumoto and Hakamaya do warrant some serious attention. Right? What are they upset about? So as I've written at length about Buddhist modernism elsewhere, I'm going to provide only the briefest overview here, just what I mean by Buddhist modernism. I would argue that one of the central tenets of Buddhist modernism, particularly as it has taken shape in the West, is the notion that the core of Buddhism lies in the Buddha's liberating experience of nirvana. This experience is supposed to be transhistorical, transcultural, and ineffable. It lies beyond the grasp of language or discursive thought. And Buddhist modernists also tend to be inclusivists. They hold that the many different traditions of Buddhism are all legitimate paths to a singular truth. In Buddhist terms, they're different fingers pointing to the same moon. As such, they feel free to dismiss intra-Buddhist controversies and debates concerning both the path and the goal as simply irrelevant distractions. So just as the modernists hold that the mystical experience of nirvana is the common goal of the tradition, they hold that meditation is the common means. And while there are a profusion of techniques, the purpose is always, according to the modernist reading, to still thought. And this is true whether one practices concentration techniques or mindfulness, smriti techniques, or visualization exercises. In each case, the aim is to quiet or silence the inner chatter so as to disclose the mind's inherent nature. Now, I'm painting with a very broad brush here, and there are certainly many areas of disagreement among Buddhist modernists, but the central argument is that the Buddhist modernism in the West is a species of perennialism. And by perennialism, I mean the doctrine, which is associated with William James and Rudolf Otto and Aldous Huxley and others, that all religious traditions ultimately originate in the transformative mystical experiences of their founders, and that once you see beyond the culturally refracted expressions of such experiences, you understand that the mystics, they're all talking about one and the same altered state of consciousness. Authentic spiritual practice is then any technique that can and is designed to elicit this particular experience. Now, the conceptual simplicity, not to mention the politically correct inclusivism of the perennialist position, accounts for much of its appeal. It is underwritten by a seemingly irrefutable logic. Namely, that we're able to distinguish, at least conceptually, between an object of consciousness and the consciousness of said object. So since conscious experience cannot be reduced to the object or content of perception alone, perennialists, like some modern phenomenologists, invoke notions like pre-reflective consciousness or pre-reflective self-awareness or pure mind, pure consciousness, the witness, the cogito, and so on. And it is this background awareness that they argue is what distinguishes conscious life from the merely reflexive behavior of an insentient machine or a zombie. The perennialists can then explain mystical experience as the direct, if somewhat paradoxical, aperception of or absorption into the knowing subject itself. There is no individuating ego in such an experience, as there is no gap between the knowing and the known. So the modern allure of perennialist philosophy may explain why it is a particular handful of Buddhist traditions, out of the hundreds that exist out there, that play such an outsized role in Western Buddhism. Right? The traditions that you all know of in Europe and America today, Chan and Zen and Dzogchen and the Burmese Vipassana and Satipatthana movements, they are precisely those forms of Buddhism that are most amenable to a perennialist interpretation. And this isn't an accident. And again, I've argued this somewhere else, I'm not going to go into it, but I've argued that these specific traditions, which are just a handful out of the hundreds, are all ones which were attempts to bring the liberating wisdom of the Buddha to a wider audience, including laypersons and those unschooled in Buddhist texts and doctrine. So in conceiving of nirvana as an experience, this is key. Nirvana means extinction. But the perennialists will turn it into an experience. The medieval Chinese Chan and Tibetan Dzogchen, like early 20th century Burmese Vipassana, mitigate the need for prolonged monastic training, for scrupulous ethical observances, for textual and doctrinal study, and so on. Nirvana suddenly becomes something that anybody can realize very quickly through meditation. Again, the issue for me is not the authenticity or the orthodoxy or even the internal coherence of the perennialist interpretation of Buddhism. My concern is the degree to which this understanding has eclipsed alternative readings of the tradition, readings that are arguably more interesting precisely because they tease out and challenge the perennialist assumptions in the contemporary reading. And for a hint of what an alternative will look like, or might look like, I'm going to start with Shenhui. Now, one of the questions is, was Shenhui a critical Buddhist? And in his article, The Meaning of Zen, Matsumoto, he claims that all Chinese Chan was directed toward the cessation of conceptual thought. And Matsumoto finds antecedents of this idea in the teachings of Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, who were the Buddha's first teachers. They were not Buddhists. This was before the Buddha was the Buddha. But he taught the Buddha these very rarefied states of consciousness, the samapatis, that are non-conceptual. And for Matsumoto, then, Chan is paradigmatic dhatuvada. And as examples, he cites Mohuyan and Shenhui, these two very important Chan teachers from the 8th century. But again, what Matsumoto doesn't focus in on is one of these was a so-called northern teacher and the other one was a southern teacher. Now, Mohuyan is widely known as the Chinese representative in the so-called Lhasa debate that were convened by the Tibetan king in the 790s. And according to what we know, that it probably wasn't a single debate, but there was some discussion going on in Tibet. Mohoyen was representing the Chinese Chan tradition, and he's facing off against the Indian Madhyamaka master Kamalashila. Now, in the extant records, Mohoyen repeatedly and unabashedly claims that awakening can be had immediately. Right? All one need to do is to stop thinking. There's no need for prior practice or training or study. Now, at one point, Kamalashila raises the question, isn't the non-thinking that you're talking about tantamount to being unconscious or insentient? By the way, this is very important. This major Indian master is assuming that non-thinking is insentience. Right? And he cites, what he says is, what differentiates a realized Chan master from the gods without conception? Now, the gods without conception, they're a particular kind of a god, but they're mindless. They have no minds at all. They have only bodies. They're zombies, really. And they populate one of the rarefied heavens in the fourth Dhyana Loka. But the key point here is that you become a god without conception because you're a heterodox yogi who thinks that the object of meditation is to stop thinking. Then you end up in this particular heaven. Now, Mohoyen's response is unapologetic. He insists that the mistake of the gods without conception was not their practice. It was rather their attachment to the conception of non-conceptuality. They just needed to free themselves from thinking. He says, those divine beings, the gods without conception, the gods without minds, they posit the existence of both meditative discernments and paths of rebirth. And they grasp at the absorption or the trance of non-conception. It is because of their deluded thoughts about this that they're born into that heaven. If they could free themselves from attachment to meditative absorption into non-thinking, then there would be no deluded thought or rebirth in that heaven. So Mohoyen, like most of the northern Chan teachers at the time, believed that if one simply abandons conceptual thought, one's inner essence or Buddha nature will naturally shine through. The language of Buddha nature, of the natural luminosity of mind as a clear mirror, it runs throughout the works associated with the northern Chan tradition and looks, at least superficially, like Dhatuvada. It's just classic Dhatuvada. So from Matsumoto's perspective, there seems to be little difference between the teachings of the northern and the southern traditions, or between Mohoyen and Shenhui. Shenhui, it is true, refers repeatedly to Buddha nature, and he too identifies Buddha nature with the nature of mind. But what Matsumoto doesn't consider is what was Shenhui so upset about? What was the source of his hostility toward the northern school? So the surviving corpus is fragmentary. They're manuscripts and manuscript fragments that were found at Dunhuang in the early 20th century. And these fragments were redacted at the hands of later editors. So it's difficult to tease out his position. But there is some evidence that Shenhui may have been closer to the critical Buddhists than Matsumoto realized. Take, for example, his stance on the Buddha nature of the insentient. Now, this was a controversial doctrine in medieval China. It was a huge doctrine. Every major Buddhist teacher had to have some opinion on the Buddha nature of insentient things, like this microphone. But by the 8th century, by the time that these debates are happening, most, if not all, of the teachers associated with the northern tradition, the northern Zen tradition, as well as with some other, with the Oxhead tradition, with the Tiantai tradition, they all embrace the notion that even insentient things such as grass and trees and stones and roof tiles, and I like to add and toxic waste dumps, that they all have Buddha nature. So this doctrine is reminiscent of the Dhatuvada or Atmavada or perennialist strands that I was describing above, because it conceives of Buddha nature as something that transcends the distinction between inside and outside, between mind and world, between sentient and insentient. Shenhui is one of the few, in fact, he's the only one that can be dated clearly from this period that rejects the doctrine. He says that it's heterodox and it's ridiculous. And again, I have a long quote here, but he's responding to this doctrine that even groves of emerald bamboos are the Dharma body of the Buddha, and that the clusters and chrysanthemums is prajna, or wisdom, or gnosis. He says, if the groves of bamboo and chrysanthemum are equal to the Dharma body and to prajna, or gnosis, in what scripture does the Buddha predict that an emerald bamboo or chrysanthemum will attain liberation? The notion that emerald bamboos and chrysanthemums are the same as the Dharma body and that wisdom and the Dharma body and wisdom is a heterodox doctrine. He rails on about this. Now, he's also concerned about moral action in Chan. And he may have felt that it was the antinomian position of the northern Chan teachers, including their support of the Buddha nature of the insentient, that it undermined their felt need to follow the precepts. In a passage that was directed at the northern Chan teachers, he says, should one claim to have attained the practice of unexcelled awakening without purifying the three actions, that's the actions of body, speech, and mind, and to have and without maintaining the rules of abstinence, there is no such thing. And he says, it was not only the northern Chan tendency to devalue the precepts that got on Shenhui's nerves. He also didn't like the fact that they would disparage the teachings, that the northern Chan teacher would say the teachings of the Buddha are the teachings found in the scriptures are simply a means toward an end. And he said, when I talk of abandoning, letting go, is central to Buddhism. He says, when I talk about letting go, I mean to let go of the false mind, not to let go of the Dharma. So the target of such comments seemed to be the northern Chan emphasis on the absolute at the expense of the conventional, and the attendant devaluation of right action and right thought. And this is one of the critical pivotal points made by the critical Buddhists. Now, Shenhui was particularly concerned with the northern Chan emphasis on seated meditation as a means toward an end, as if concentration exercises directed towards stilling thought would yield insight. He says, I'm quoting, don't lower the eyes in front of you, as you'll just fall into abiding in gazing, which is just useless. You should not have the intention to focus the mind or concentrate the mind. And don't look far away or close. This is all useless. Continuing the quote, non-abiding is quiescence, and the embodiment of quiescence is called meditation. From this embodiment comes spontaneously knowledge, and the awareness of the embodiment of this basic quiescence is what we mean by wisdom. This is the quality of meditation and wisdom. And then he says, when the scripture says, from quiescence arises clarity, this is what it's talking about. The non-abiding mind is not apart from knowing. Right? Knowing, think conceptuality, think some kind of insight. And knowing is not apart from non-abiding. Know that mind is not abiding, and there is nothing else you need to know. In other words, just sitting still, employing some sort of technique to quiet the mind or to just be in the present, this is not real quiescence or wisdom. Practice requires fundamental insight or understanding, and this understanding is of the non-abiding of mind itself. He says, friends, listen carefully as I explain deluded mind. What is deluded mind? You all came here today to listen, but you still have desires for wealth and sensory experiences and men and women and sex and so on, or you're thinking of luxurious gardens and mansions. This is gross delusion. And of course you must rid yourself of this kind of mind. What you don't know about is subtle delusion. Subtle delusion is when the mind hears of awakening, it gives rise to the thought that grasps at awakening. And when you hear of nirvana, you give rise to a mind that grasps at nirvana. These are all delusions and are fetters of the Dharma. They're being bound to the teachings. These are to have a view of the Dharma. The mind that functions in this way will not attain liberation because it is not your fundamentally and intrinsically quiescent mind. And he goes up. So here you can see Shenhui's overriding concern about the growing number of teachers who claim to be transmitting the central teachings of Buddhism, emptiness, non-discrimination, and awakening, but who themselves have no real insight. They set themselves up as masters and promote a relatively simple meditation technique, yet they have neither the official sanction of the tradition nor the wisdom that warrants it. By the way, I was reading this passage, I really began to think of the modern mindfulness movement and the proliferation of Buddhist teachers in America today. So commenting on the deleterious effects of one of these northern teachers, a very influential one named Shen Xiao, Shenhui says, he must have 20 or more disciples who preach Zen and teach people, but none of them have received the transmission or permission to preach in such a manner. And descending from these 20 or more, there's now several hundred people preaching and teaching people with no sense of hierarchy, without any master-disciple affection. They're all struggling for name and profit, and they don't have any official status. They sow confusion among the true teachings. They confuse students of the way. These are the signs of the disappearance of the Buddha Dharma, and so on. He's pretty upset. So in short, he does use the language of Buddha nature, but he seems adamant that it not be construed as a dhatu, as a something to be realized, or as a locus, or as a place to take rest. The focus of his teaching is precisely non-abiding. The insight that there is no ground, no place in which to come to rest, and this is why he privileges Prajnaparamita teachings of the Diamond Sutra over the Yogacara teachings of the Lankavatara. Now this position, was there a handout? Did people get the handout? Okay, coming to the handout. The Shenhui's position, especially his use of the language of Buddha nature, turns out to be really difficult to pin down. The ambiguity, if not the confusion, may be seen in the famous verses of the Platform Sutra, which apparently befuddled many early editors. Shen Xiao, now Shen Xiao is the bad guy. Shen Hui and Shen Xiao, their names sound the same if you don't know Chinese. But the bad guy in the text, the leader of the northern faction, he presents his basic understanding of the teachings with the following verse. The body is the Bodhi tree, the mind is like a clear mirror, at all times we must strive to polish it and must not let the dust collect it. Very famous verse. It represents what in the later tradition was a poor understanding of the Dharma. Right? And also notice that it is classic Buddha nature theory, kam dhatuvada or kam perennialism. Awakening, according to the verse, it's available right here and right now. You simply need to allow the intrinsically pure or luminous nature of the mind to shine forth. And you do this by polishing the mind, which is sitting still, focusing, collecting, concentrating the mind, allowing thoughts to subside. Now, to this, in the Dunhuang version of the Platform Sutra, Huineng, who's the hero of the story, he's the one with the correct view, he says, Bodhi is awakening. Bodhi originally has no tree. The mirror has no stand. Buddha nature is always clean and pure. Where is there room for dust? And this is an odd verse. On the one hand, it's an attack on the reification of awakening, the Bodhi, and mind, which is the mirror. Both are deemed groundless. But at the same time, the verse affirms the purity of inherent Buddha nature. And because, perhaps, it was because of this reification of Buddha nature that some later compiler of the Dunhuang edition, the edition that survives today, manuscript edition from Dunhuang, he somewhat incongruously includes an alternative version of Huineng's response. He just gives, well, Huineng gave these two responses. And this one goes, the mind is the Bodhi tree, the body is the mirror stand, the mirror is originally clean and pure, where can it be stained by dust? Now, the author of this second version has removed all mention of Buddha nature, but he still struggles in his attempt to formulate a consistent and coherent alternative to Shen Xiao and the Northern teaching, and he ends up affirming the intrinsic purity of both mind and body. A critical Buddhist would not like this. After all, what is the originally clear, clean, and pure mirror if not the mind as Buddha nature? And so it's significant that the editors continue to tinker with the verse, which is supposed to embody the very essence of the Southern teaching. And finally they come up with, we don't fully understand the process, but the version that appears in the Song Vulgate version, which is at least a century after the versions that we have here, is the following. Bodhi originally has no tree. The bright mirror also is not a stand. Originally there is not a single thing. What is there to attract dust? So now the problematic line, the third line, has been replaced with the apophatic declaration, originally there is not a single thing, i.e. there is no body, there's no mind, there's no mirror, there's no purity, there's no Buddha nature, there's nothing. And notice as well how the fourth line has been altered. Rather than saying the mirror can't be stained by dust, it says that there is nothing to attract dust in the first place. So Shenhui's writings may be muddled, and indeed the platform scripture is itself far from philosophically consistent, but at least Hui Neng's celebrated transmission verse, which is supposed to capture the essence of the southern critique of the northern teachings, it was finally rendered cogent. So, I mean, in short, what I'm saying is the fact that the compilers of the platform sutra were already struggling to figure out what exactly this position is, it makes it more understandable why we, 1,200 years later, would really have a struggle in dealing with Shenhui's materials. But to recap, Shenhui appears to have been taken aback by aspects of the Northern Shan teachings that, in his mind, misrepresent the goal of practice. They devalue ethics, they devalue the scriptures, and they overvalue meditation. In articulating his alternative to the Northern teaching, he emphasizes non-abiding, a notion closely associated with the Diamond Sutra, and one which cuts across and unifies doctrine, practice, and goal. Now, Matsumoto and Hakamaya don't provide much of an alternative to perennialist or Dhatuvada Buddhism. For them, it just seems to be a certain kind of what Buddhologists know as prasangika critique, or it's a kind of deconstructive logical analysis. But even then, their intended audience are insiders. They're East Asian Buddhists, led astray by this perennialism, and they don't seem to have much to offer a non-Buddhist who asks the question, why should I care about Buddhism in the first place? In my remaining time, I'm going to briefly try to address this lacuna. So the focus of critical Buddhism is the doctrine of anatma, or non-self, which they feel has been adulterated by the Dhatuvada, or perennialist, way of reading the tradition. The Buddhist teaching of non-self famously holds that we are comprised entirely of the five aggregates, and that these aggregates are in perpetual flux. There isn't anything that stands apart from or behind this flux. There is, in short, no abiding mind. The notion that there is a stable center that takes in the world is a confabulation. Mind, and here is the word I have in mind is the Sanskrit mano or manas, in early Buddhism, in early Buddhist Abhidharma, is simply another sense organ. And it is no more constitutive of the self and no more reliable than are the other five senses. Right? So according to the Buddhists, Descartes had it wrong. Everything, including the existence of the cogito, is susceptible to doubt. Now, to grasp just how this works, I'd like to talk about the process of seeing, or vision. The eyes seem to present us with a relatively stable, fine-grained, continuous technicolor field in which we situate ourselves. But neuroscience tells us that this is not actually what is going on. The eye is actually hunting and pecking, with a small recessed portion of the retina, known as the fovea, fixating on a tiny area, only about 2 degrees of our visual field. The fovea consists of densely packed cone receptors. There are no rods and almost no blood vessels, which is why it has very high visual acuity. While the fovea is relatively tiny, taking up only about 1% of the surface of the retina, it is this area that can attain full color 20/20 resolution. The much larger peripheral regions of the retina, which cover the remainder of the visual field, are good at detecting movement, and they are more sensitive in low light, but at the cost of low resolution and very poor, often no color detection at all. This all seems to be a colored field, but the colored part is actually just in the middle. The fovea stays fixed on a point for a mere fraction of a second before jumping somewhere else in a rapid movement known as a saccade. There are about 3 or 4 saccades per second as the fovea jerks around exploring adjacent areas. Our neural machinery tricks us, as it were, stitching together the resulting bursts of data and giving the impression that we are presented with a single, continuous, high-resolution, colorful scene. It seems like our eyes are a window on the world, passively encoding visual data, but there is nothing passive about the process. There is no pre-existing visual field possessing things like color and shape that is then presented to the retina and then transduced to the visual cortex. What we see is a mental construct being produced on the fly. We are unable to detect, at least directly, much less control, the jerky saccading movements of our eyes. And even if we could learn to steady the eye and stop the movements, it wouldn't yield a steadier image, but rather no image at all, since the photoreceptors need continual stimulation lest they become unresponsive. This means that not only is our sense of being presented with a continuous and stable world a construct, but so too is our sense of a continuous flow of time. The continuity is an artifact of our inability to detect the gaps. The gaps do not exist for us. And most important, the neural and cognitive processing that gives rise to this construct is happening subliminally, well below the threshold of conscious awareness. So, Buddhism holds that the mind organ, or the mind sense, works in the same way as the visual sense. The mind is continually jerking around. It's saccading from one thought and feeling and image and idea to another. We may think that there's some sort of stable self or subject that sits behind this incessant jerking, and that exists some degree of control over it, but the saccading of the mind is no more subject to conscious control than the saccading of our eyes. The sense that there is a stable or enduring self or subject at the center of or behind all of this activity is an illusion. Just as we imagine ourselves at the center of a stable and continuous visual field, and just as we imagine ourselves unfolding in a continuous temporal flow, we imagine that, at the center of it all, there's a subject or agent that is me. The Buddhists insist that this is all a confabulation. There is no self-determining center to subjective awareness. From the viewpoint of evolutionary biology, the illusion of being a unified self provides certain adaptive advantages. You get very close to Dennett's argument for the intentional fallacy, if you're familiar with Dennett. But the Buddhists believe it is also responsible for our existential anxiety, or our dukkha. Now, there's a popular idea that Buddhist meditation, at least as traditionally conceived, teaches you how to discipline or control the mind. You learn to focus or concentrate on a single object for increasing periods of time. This may be misleading. From the perspective of a critical Buddhist, Buddhist meditation exercises are intended not to exert control over the mind, since there is no self to exercise such control. Rather, the point of meditation is to disclose just how entirely out of control the situation is. One attends to the inner flow of thoughts and feelings so as to learn to see them as the fleeting and impersonal objects of the mind sense that they are, and this diminishes the tendency to self-identify with the contents of thoughts and feelings. So the object is not to gain control, but to let go of the illusion that there is anyone who is situated to control any of this. So from a Buddhist perspective, the gap that divides the sane and the insane is not as great as one might imagine. We're all living in imaginary worlds, all under the spell of an inner voice that we believe is in charge. Think of watching a football game on TV and listening to the play-by-play that accompanies it. Now imagine that the sportscaster, sitting up in the booth way up high, is under the illusion that his play-by-play is actually determining rather than simply following the activity on the field. according to the Buddhists, this is precisely the mistake we make when we identify with our inner voice. We think our incessant inner chatter is doing something, that it's making things happen, when in fact it is just an impersonal artifact of the mind sense, in the same way that the visual world is an impersonal artifact of our visual system. Buddhist meditation is intended then not to uncover the true self, but rather to disclose the fact that there's nobody at home. Now, to say that the self, I'm coming to an end here, to say that the self, and indeed the world, is a confabulation or an ephemeral and discontinuous construct does not mean that there is anything random or haphazard about the manner in which things unfold. Buddhist doctrine holds that the world of our experience is determined by karma, which are the causal effects of past activity, but that the complexities and intricacies of the causal chains are utterly beyond our capacity to unravel. The easiest way to understand karma is that it is simply everything that has ever happened that led you to being here today, to you being a human being, born at such and such a time, in such a place, with such and such parents, with such and such DNA, and so on. It is all the past stuff that determines who and what you are, a full account of which would have to go back to the Big Bang. Right? And actually, the Buddhists think it goes a lot farther back than that. So as such, you can't disentangle the causal change, much less change them. So the only thing to do is accept it. Now, let me introduce one more Buddhist distinction, and that's between the self and the person. The self, or the Atman, to use the Sanskrit term, in early Indian philosophy is an enduring, independent center of our being. It is who and what we really are once you remove all of the accidents of personal history, the happenstance, and so on, once karma is stripped away. It is what makes me a unified subject or agent capable of autonomous thought and action. Right? So that's what the Buddhists say doesn't exist. The person, and I'm here translating sometimes the Buddhists use the term a pudgala, it is an emergent, intersubjective, interdependent construct. So the Buddhist teachings deny that there is a self, but they do not deny that we are persons. Selves are, by definition, irreducible metaphysical singularities, whereas persons emerge within a particular historical, cultural, linguistic, and social network. So today, philosophers and cognitive scientists talk about the transactional self, or the embodied self, or the enacted self, and so on. They're all attempts to get at what I'm calling our intersubjective personhood. And it is mistaking this emergent person for a substantial and enduring self that is the cause of our suffering. So what does a critical Buddhist suggest we do about it? The response in terms of practice is simple, if not simplistic, and it's just to let go, because there is nothing to hang on to. And this is where I differentiate a critical Buddhist understanding of Buddhism from the Dhatuvada account. Nirvana, in the critical reading, is not an experience of some kind of primordial or inexpressible truth. It is not a state of transcendence in which one is freed or set apart from a causally conditioned flux. Nirvana is the end of an illusion. It is giving up the self as well as anything that might substitute for a self, such as pure mind or Buddha nature or abiding luminosity or witness consciousness or whatever, what have you. It is going into free fall. But to quote a popular song by Florence Welch, falling is not the problem. When I'm falling, I'm in peace. It is only when I hit the ground, it causes all the grief. But if there is no ground, there's no problem. Right? So this, in short, is what a modern alternative to perennialist Buddhism might look like. It shares with Shenhui, Matsumoto, and Hakamaya a frustration with the dumbed-down versions of Buddhism in vogue today. A Buddhism that is pathologically allergic to critical thought and that takes refuge in the faith that meditation can cure all that ails you. But at the same time, I would distance myself from the critical Buddhists insofar as I don't claim that this reading is more authentic or true or what the Buddha taught than something else. I just think it has more to bring to the table particularly in dialogue with contemporary currents in philosophy of mind, cognitive psychology, political theory, and ethics. In contrast, I find the Dhatuvada, or perennialist alternative, to offer little that we don't already know. Indeed, as I've argued elsewhere, the mindfulness movement tends to reinforce rather than challenge prevailing epistemological, social, and ethical assumptions and commitments. But of course, here in criticizing the other critical Buddhists, I'm simply showing myself as a bona fide critical Buddhist, because you have to pick fights with everybody, including other critical Buddhists, to earn your stripes. So, thank you.
But I'm wondering, is it more interesting if we actually start teasing out some differences? Because if you can start looking at two verses, if you pay attention to some differences there, the first one might be the Buddha nature, but we might say the second one, the mirror is originally clean and pure, where can we stand by dust? That could be the editor's, you know, trying to put a Yogacara meaning of Koine. Just, I'm wondering if you think that's a really useful thing to do. And the second, in regards to the Matsumoto critical Buddhists in Japan, did they go after the Yogacara Mongolian tradition as much as they went after the Buddha nature?
Well, yeah. So yoga, I mean, we can talk afterwards.
Okay.
This gets into, it gets really complicated really quick. So my own reading of Yogacara, I have an article, if you go to the Journal of Indian Philosophy website, which just came out a few weeks ago, the argument is that with Dignaga and Dharmakirti, and with the Pramanavada tradition, Yogacara takes a turn, and it takes a turn toward phenomenology, in the sense that it kind of, it's trying to give an account of what shows up in a way that really believes is a there. And the argument is that pre-Dignaga, Yogacara is much more aligned with the Abhidharmic tradition, in which everything is going on behind the scenes. It's all in the subliminal machinery. So they don't end up with Dasein. They don't end up with there being a there. But you do get that with Dignaga and Dharmakirti for very specific reasons. The Chinese, I try to show using the Cheng Wei Shulun, that's going to a different tradition, it's going to Dharmapala's tradition, never go the phenomenological route. So it's a short way of saying, let's talk about it afterwards because the non-specialists will get bored very quickly, but Yogacara is really complicated, and particularly in China, because there's so many different traditions that all claim to be Yogacara, but they're all doing really different things. But if you want to say that is Yogacara in the mix on both the southern and northern, and yes. But that's why I think it's important to get clear on, well, if Yogacara is in the mix, it doesn't necessarily mean the Yogacara tradition as it is represented in the like later Tibetan tradition, which sees Dignaga and Dharmakirti as continuous with an early tradition rather than doing something really radically different. Yes.
I appreciate your lecture. I never got out of it. I know you're a Buddhist scholar, but in keeping with religious studies and what you were talking about in terms of maybe I got it like the inner voice and close to maybe being sane and insane. And this is, I guess, for Christianity, but it speaks to your lecture. The inner voice in Christianity, one would say it's the negative voice and then the positive voice, or the dark side, or Lucifer, the devil, Satan, and God. just speak to that in the closeness of the two inner voices, please? Thank you.
It would take a lot, again, a lot of what, I think that you could work up a Buddhist response to how would Buddhists understand the multiple, you know, the voices you're talking about. But so just to step back a bit, in Buddhism, there is no sin. There's no kind of original sin. There's no Lucifer. There's only ignorance. So the idea is, well, what is wisdom? What is the opposite of ignorance? And one of the issues that is running through this struggle is all conceptuality, is the inner chatter always standing in the way of something? Is it always blocking the truth? And so that's one of the struggles that they're having. Is there such a good thing as right thoughts? In the Eightfold Path, there's something that you could translate as right view or right thoughts. Shenhui is saying we can't abandon that. Another way to run at this is in Madhyamika, very influential Buddhist school that everybody always wants to conform. No matter what you are, you want to conform with Madhyamika, the emptiness school. They distinguish between absolute truth, which is the truth that is apart from any relative conception of the world, and conventional truth. The problem is, as many people pointed out, they don't ever tell you how to... Conventional truth would be, you know, our conventional understanding of the world. But they don't actually address the issue of how to distinguish between conventional truth and conventional falsehood, which is, in a way, what you're asking for in Buddhist terms. So you could say that it is an underdeveloped area in Buddhist thought. That people later, it's not that it's not touched by later scholiasts, but they always have trouble because the sort of core, the root texts, don't give you much to hold on to. So the issue becomes primarily, is thought as such helpful or a hindrance? Yes?
Does critical Buddhism have a critique of ritual practice, per se, as a kind of misleading attachment? I mean, is it also focused on sort of issues of practices other than meditation and issues that aren't, I guess, so purely thought? Sort of ritual accretions from, say, ritual practices with which Buddhists are coming into contact?
So the easy... Well, first of all, they've written a lot. I have not read everything they've written. But for the most part, I am steering this toward a Buddhism that is understood in America that really privileges meditation as being somehow central to the Buddhist tradition. It is interesting that in Asia and in Japan, they don't necessarily share that idea. It's a kind of contemporary idea. It's not that meditation doesn't go back. It wasn't always important. But it wasn't always the be-all and end-all. And as many people pointed out, a relatively few Buddhist monks throughout the ages meditated. So their target isn't meditation. Their target, and they are, they're scholars. So their target isn't Buddhist practice. Their target is a certain understanding of Buddhism. But I think it would be fair to say that they have very little interest in Buddhist ritual practice. That would look at them, that would look to them, I think, as simple piety. And they are modernists in the sense that they think, you know, the Buddhism that we should really be concerned about is a Buddhism which is a central, for lack of a better word, a central insight. That they're insisting thought and the critical use of the intellect and rationality is absolutely central for that. So my guess is, I can't think of anything offhand, but I'm thinking there's a lot that I haven't read, but my guess is that they don't have that much interest in ritual. It's just, you know, this was a thing, these guys published this. It was a kind of big deal among, it was a storm in a teacup, right? Because it's only other Buddhist scholars in Japan who paid any attention to this. Buddhists, like your average practicing Buddhist, they have no idea who these guys are. They don't, any more than, you know, a Catholic or a Protestant would be following contemporary trends in Catholic or Protestant theology. This was a kind of very abstract level of theological discourse. But Westerners got very excited about it, I think in part because it looked for a long time like there was no interesting stuff happening intellectually in the Japanese Buddhist world. And then suddenly two people are really stirring things up, and it got people excited. Yes, Mario.
A couple of things, somewhat related, but not necessarily I mean, first of all, thank you for the lecture. It's wonderful. There are so many issues about Shenkhoi, about critical Buddhism, and so on. But somewhat, how does that relate to contemporary understanding of Buddhism in the United States in terms of this meditation equals Buddhism kind of paradigm? That is basically the main critique, the starting point of your critique. And the second part is about the role of scholars such as yourself, or maybe some other people in your life, in terms of engaging in this. I remember, probably you have forgotten, but some years back we were walking somewhere in California, and you told me... Okay, you remember, there you go. you told me, we were talking about some of these issues, and you said, well, about Americans who get interested in Buddhism, he said, look, most of these people are very self-centered, or I would put it, I don't think you use the same word, but a little bit egomaniacal kind of self-absorbed. I think he said self-absorbed individuals. Now, and how does this, so there's a certain notion of selfhood, which is kind of constructed, it's culturally constructed, is built into some, maybe he said, psychotherapeutic paradigms and notions of self-improvement and so on. And I think, if I understand correctly, this is part of your critique, but especially this kind of Buddha nature notion, how that kind of makes it even worse, because I've noticed with people who practice Buddhism and you say like, oh, you know, you're Buddha, oh, wonderful, I thought I was wonderful, but now even more wonderful. Yeah, people's eyes light up, except, I mean, if there is a thing that egomaniacs don't need is that, you know, you're not just a center, but you're one, you're Buddha, you're the universe itself. So there's that kind of pernicious effect on the Buddha nature, talking, inspiring as it might be in terms of motivating people to do. So this is both in terms of strategies of proselytizing about Buddhism. And the second kind of related issue is that how you situate yourself, because I spent lots of time in Germany where kind of academies organized, and I had more opportunity to do, like German universities have theology departments, and some of the discussions, some of the issues, and of course I was at Commerzau actually, when Matsumoto was doing this kind of thing, so I got some conversation with him, which is also kind of Buddhist institutions, so they have different things. They're coming from Berkeley, but in a sense you participate in this, in terms of how you situate yourself, how these boundaries between secular university and partial scholars, because from what I can see, you want to change the discourse. I mean, you're open at many levels, but it's part of the agenda basically to propose a certain way of Buddhism that you think it's maybe more wholesome, more helpful, more correct than some of the distortions that we might see in the norm. That is to say, how you participate in the larger discussion about what Buddhism is, how it should be understood, how it should be practiced, how it should be appropriate or misappropriate in a North American context. Yeah.
So I'm going to try to keep all those things. So briefly, again, there's all sorts of stuff there, but as I say, I'm not trying to say that this is correct or this is true or this is true Buddhism. What I'm trying to do is draw attention to an alternative reading of Buddhism, which has been really, it's just not in play. And why would I do that? Because I think it's more interesting. You know, I'm a Buddhist scholar. I would like to think that the stuff that I spent my life studying has some purchase outside a small group of textual, you know, scholars interested in textual work. But I think it's my job to articulate what exactly it brings to the table. And the problem is that I just find the perennialist argument, even if they're right, even if that's original Buddhism, even if that ultimately is liberative, intellectually, it's just not very interesting. Whereas you have this other tradition, which is extraordinarily rich. They really are grappling with issues that are absolutely front and center in contemporary philosophy of mind, cognitive psychology, the issues that have become very salient now. You see that in popular culture too, now that we have machines that are becoming more and more sophisticated. Is it simply a matter of sophistication and self-reflection that makes us think that we're sentient, that makes us think that we're not just complex physical structures? What do we mean by physical in the first place? All these are issues that the Buddhists have been struggling with for 2,000 years. They have lots to bring to the table, but people don't see it because they kind of buy the Buddha nature reading. So that would be how I would situate myself. In other words, I don't think that I'm doing something theological, But I do think that I have to engage in this messy world of contemporary Buddhist debate in order to open a space for alternative. You know, that was the early stuff that I did on experience was the same thing. It was just trying to say, look, this particular category, which you're using as the category through which you see the Buddhist tradition, it actually is, you know, it's a relatively recent provenance, and it doesn't mean that it's not useful, but there are, it obscures other ways of seeing it. I wouldn't say that, like, Buddhist meditators are any more self-obsessed or narcissistic than other people. I just think that it's a point that others have made. When Buddhism moved from India to China, it gets translated into the language of Taoism because that's the language that they thought was just more appropriate. And what it really means is that the people who were reading what we now call Taoist texts, they were the ones who gravitated toward Buddhism. They were the kind of alternative hippies of the time. When Buddhism came to America, it gets translated into the language of psychology. Not necessarily because Buddhism is psychology, but it was because people were interested in spirituality, they were interested in the inner life of the mind, they were interested in psychology. They were the ones who were gravitating toward Buddhism, and they translated it into terms that were salient to them. So it just, the whole Buddhism becomes psychologized. I do think that contemporary practitioners who run to Buddhism and practice Buddhism, one of the things that they suffer from, is a certain kind of fractured selfhood. It's a fractured selfhood that I think is just endemic in contemporary society. It has to do with, it's a whole other lecture. It has to do with the breakdown of familial structures and tribal structures that human beings have lived in for tens of thousands of years, if not hundreds of thousands of years. Suddenly, in a short space of a few centuries, it breaks down. And now not only is the extended family and tribe broken down, but the nuclear family has broken down. So when we talk about, as Robert Bellah once said, you have to have a self in order to lose it. And in other words, the critique of the self presumes an in-place person. And it gets very muddled when you have people who don't have an in-place person then playing with these ideas of non-self. So to get back to your question, I think why Buddha nature appeals is it promises a stability that we lack psychologically. And that's kind of altered the discussion, but I'm kind of rambling here. But that's the way I would run with it. It's this, and again, I'm not saying anything. I don't believe that Buddhist practitioners are any more troubled than anybody else. They're seekers. But I do think that the situation that we're all in with the breakdown of familial and tribal structures puts us in a different situation than you would be if you were a medieval monk in India or China or Japan. Yes?
Presence of objects.
Like what?
You talk about investing sort of objects with a kind of embodying objects, like the microphone, you said.
The Buddha nature of the insentient, yes.
The insentient, thank you. And I guess what I'm thinking about is a sort of elaborate architecture that comes with modern thing theory. And I'm wondering kind of, are there any points of conflict, I imagine there are, or overlap, or where does this intersect with?
I just don't know. I know that exists out there as a whole new thing in the academy. I haven't. I kind of went into it a little bit, and I wasn't. I mean, my avenue in is actually with objects of it. It's with icons, the worship of icons, and that's where people like Alfred Gell. I don't know if you include Gell in that world, but people like that coming out of art history and why we invest art objects with a kind of sentient quality to them. But that, I think that's different than thing theory. And I just don't know enough about it to comment on it. Where I do think it is definitely resonates, though, is the debate about the Buddha nature of insentient objects gets a lot into fundamental distinctions that we make, that we think are out there. Like, we have a sentient agent detection module in our brain. This has been fairly well worked out in cognitive psychology and in cognitive neuroscience. So that when we see something that triggers that sentient module, we respond differently than when we don't, and we have, it's inborn. Right? And it has to do with, people know this, it has to do with configuration of eyes and so on. It has to be in a very specific direction and so on. What's interesting about that is if we have a sentient agent detection module, the tendency is to think that it has given us some selective evolutionary advantage because it is detecting something that's out there. But that's not at all the conclusion that we need to get from. What it might mean is it's like colors. You know, the fact that we see colors gives us a kind of evolutionary advantage, but the colors aren't out there. In the same way that the distinction we make between sentient and insentient may actually be hardwired into the brain, but it's not out there. And the Buddhists are actually trying to think behind that and say, is that distinction between sentient and insentient, between physical and mental, is it real or not? And that gets really, gets to me, very interesting, but it's a different direction, I think, than the theoretical direction. It may not be. Anything else?
So these two potentially quick questions. It seems that critical Buddhism seems to be critiquing the popular view of Buddhism, kind of like people semi-insight being that they're scholars, coming out and going, no, this isn't really what Buddhism is about. It's way more than that. So in a sense, it seems like it's almost now trying to get scholars out of the office and the study in the library and into the field to advertise, for lack of a better word, maybe more accurate understanding of Buddhism. And somewhat related to, in terms of critical Buddhism, are they critiquing all other trends? Because you mentioned that the two Japanese scholars also critique the Soto school. So are they critiquing other schools as
right.
well? Like,
yeah. So let me just clarify, because I went through a lot of stuff very quickly. Critical Buddhism is a movement that consists of two people. It is not, and the two people, last time I spoke with Matsumoto, he disagrees a lot with Hakamai. So I said, okay, so you split, right? They had a sectarian faction. They're splittists. And now they have two movements with one person in each. So first of all, it's, you know, this the storm in the teacup kind of thing. Their target was East Asian Buddhism. It wasn't popular Buddhism. That's what I was saying before. It's not ritual. It's not meditation. It's not popular Buddhism. Their target was the whole of East Asian Buddhism. They said it went off the rails when they adopted this kind of Buddha nature thing. So they're actually, their target is actually very hybrid. It's the fundamental texts and exegetical commentaries and so on that are foundational to all of East Asian Buddhist thought, with one exception. And that is the founder of the Soto tradition. And this is why Western scholars don't pay any attention to them, because it looks apologetic. They're saying the only one who got it right was the founder of our tradition, and everybody who succeeded the founder got it wrong. Now, as an aside, for those who are kind of the Buddhologists among you, they're not completely nuts, I don't think. Because there is a text, an absolutely foundational text in the East Asian tradition. It's the Yuanzhi Jing, the Sutra of Original Awakening, that we now know is it's a very Buddha nature text. We also know that it's an apocryphal text. It claims to be an Indian sutra, but it wasn't. It was written in China. We only know that since the 20th century. Philological techniques have shown this. But there was one person in East Asian history who raised questions about the authority of that text, and that was Dogen. That was this one guy. He was the only one who would come out and say, this text that everybody thinks is a scripture from the Buddha, from India, is a fake. That's interesting. And why did he say that? It was because of the Buddha nature stuff going on in the text. So they're not completely nuts, but it's a very polemical thing that they're doing. And it was very much wrapped up again. Their real interest was, why did the Soto school, why did their Zen tradition, why were they so culpable? Why did they support the military buildup in Japan? Why did they support the discrimination against the Budokumon? by keeping family records of people who are Burakumin. Burakumin is sort of an outcast. They're outcasts in Japan. And the Zen school was very complicit with a kind of social discriminatory practices in Japan. So they would say, how did Buddhism go off the rails? How did we ever become this kind of... And their solution is, well, we got the philosophy wrong. We left the teachings of Shakyamuni somewhere. So that's just to correct all that. I'm saying people tend to... It's easy to discount what the critical Buddhists are doing. But behind it all, look, Shenhui in the 8th century, he was raising some of these same issues. And maybe we shouldn't be so quick to discount them, even though they're being patently polemical and they're supporting Dogen and doing other things that nobody would, you know, no Western scholar accepts the view that the entire East Asian tradition went off the rails except for the founder of the Soto Zen school. It's just implausible.
I know some of you may still want to ask questions, but let's end here.